Introduction to Shakespeare's History Plays, Part 1 of 2. Section: What are history plays? What are history plays in the Shakespearean context? Well, they're just plays grounded in some version of English history, but whose prime directive is to entertain, which justifies quite a lot of changing and rearranging of events and recastings of character for dramatic purposes. Why wouldn't, say, Macbeth be classified this way? Probably because the play isn't about Scottish history in any deep sense. Macbeth fits into the tragic genre so well that we would feel strange calling it anything but a tragedy. In a true history play, with all its events and pageantry, there just wouldn't be mental or emotional room for a character like Macbeth, with his second guessings, deep inwardness, and so forth. Shakespeare didn't invent the dramatic genre we call history plays. It was a phenomenon of the 1580s and 1590s. Christopher Marlowe's Edward II is a fine example, and others are The True Tragedy of Richard III, The Troublesome Reign of King John, and The Famous Victories of Henry V. These latter three plays were performed by the Queen's Men Acting Company, 1583 to 1591. Still, there wasn't a long tradition to draw from. A growing sentiment of nationalism in early modern England led to the flourishing of this genre. The English apparently wanted to see their history reflected back to them, and Shakespeare was happy to oblige. While Shakespeare didn't invent the history play, English history retains its fascination for us moderns in large part because certain lucky kings and queens had a great dramatist to help them strut their stuff. As Scott McMillan and Sally Beth McLean point out in their 2006 Cambridge UP book, The Queen's Men and Their Plays, nobody has thus far heard a whisper about the next Queen's Men Drama Festival. But Shakespeare's efforts? That's another and more memorable story. As Cassius asks his fellow conspirators in Julius Caesar, quote-unquote, "How many ages hence shall this our lofty scene be acted over in states unborn and accents yet unknown?" Consider a modern example. While JFK was a complex, intelligent man whose presidency was already consequential by November 1963, does anybody think he would exercise the continuing fascination that he does without the Arthurian Camelot legend woven around him by his family, his advisors, and above all, by his wife Jackie? She is the one who made her husband's funeral an unforgettable symbolic event, something for the ages. Even a lifetime on, there is something of the doomed hero king about JFK in our collective cultural memory. In an older context, Abraham Lincoln was remarkable enough to have been remembered no matter what, but Walt Whitman cemented our 16th president's status as an American symbol with his moving elegy, "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." That is the sort of thing that Shakespeare has done for English history. Great Britain is a sophisticated little island country now, not a great power like America, but to this day they cast a huge shadow. If you're interested in using Shakespeare to meditate on modern politics, by the way, Elliot A. Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, has written a book called The Hollow Crown, Shakespeare on How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall, Basic Books, 2023. Are Shakespeare's history plays history in the sense of true objective narration? Well, as I suggested earlier, no. While they have a factual basis and render the grand sweep of English history faithfully enough, the playwright does a great deal of rearranging and telescoping of events, and the sources from which he drew, mainly Raphael Holinshed's Chronicles, were not objective in the first place. To some extent, they read like what Winston Churchill called history as it ought to have been, not as it happened down to the last detail. Shakespeare didn't whitewash English history, but he did adapt it to his dramatic purposes. For example, there's no proof that Richard III really ordered those famous lads in the tower killed, but it's logical to assume that either he or his high-ranking follower Buckingham were responsible, since both had means and motive to want Edward IV's heirs out of the way. Shakespeare's play, in accordance with the Tudor bias against the Yorkist Richard III, casts this conviction as a moral imperative, an ought, so the wicked king ends up chortling that the princes, quote-unquote, sleep in Abraham's bosom. Aristotle lays down the premise in his Poetics that historians are at a disadvantage with respect to poets, because they, unlike poets, are bound to represent the ugly and sometimes chaotic scenes of actual history. We know that sometimes the bad guys win and the good guys lose. Things don't often happen in an ethically satisfying or even coherent manner. History is the record of life, and it's often a mess because life is a mess. Aristotle writes that the historian and the poet differ in that, quote-unquote, the former relates things that have happened, the latter, things that may happen. For that reason, he suggests, quote-unquote, poetry is a more philosophical and more serious thing than history. Poetry tends to speak of universals, history of particulars. 1451b. If we like that line of thinking, poets are free to give us an intelligible and morally satisfying representation of historical events and people. They are at liberty to construct recognizable scenes from chaotic events, and to derive ethical and intellectual clarity from the welter of motivations that have driven the great men and women of history. To be fair, though, modern historians would point out that they too are weavers of plots that follow the ways of fictional narratives. See, for example, Hayden White's groundbreaking 1973 Johns Hopkins University book, Metahistory. There is no simple unified truth when we are dealing with complicated, murky events. None of this is to say that Shakespeare gives us history for dummies. If you read widely in his histories, you'll find that the playwright manages to do two things at once. Number one, pay tribute to the contingency of many of history's events and to the complexity of historical agents. And number two, give us a sense that history adds up to something, that there are lessons to be learned about ethics and power from this crazy pageant of people and deeds. That accomplishment is apparent in the plays we will be examining. In terms of making sense of history, Shakespeare's history genre is at base teleological. It leads us to the rightness of Queen Elizabeth I's Tudor reign. All roads lead to Gloriana, the real-life fairy queen celebrated by Edmund Spenser. Only Henry VIII was written after the death of Queen Elizabeth I. Section. So close and yet so far, the environment at court and family relations. The environment in medieval courtly systems was treacherous, even before the time of royal absolutism and the centralized court. There was great danger in personal intimate proximity to power. A person so highly placed was always close not only to power, but also to chaos. He or she was dancing in an incredibly small circle, illuminated by the brightest torchlight. Intense aristocratic competition was a daily reality, even though the great aristocrats were privileged in ways that the common folk, who suffered from a great deal of want and injustice, could scarcely imagine. We might ask ourselves as a little thought experiment, if the king were our eldest sibling, and we were first in line after him, would we loyally maintain his image and authority, or not? There is a vast distinction in status between a king and his next sibling, though both are royals. Consider the strangeness of this, the sense of intimacy and proximity smashing right up alongside the reality of seemingly infinite distance, so close to absolute sole power, and yet so far. Such circumstances could easily warp people's minds, causing them to lose their moral bearings and make a play for the top position, occupied by their brother or sister or cousin or other relative. That's probably why monarchs and dictators never seem to sleep well. How could they? Seething resentments may develop from this near-far distinction, and we might say that the problem comes of treating a human being like a god. Biographers say Richard of Gloucester admired his older brother Edward, and that Edward trusted him, but the record shows that when it came time to make his decision to take the crown for himself, Richard sided with himself, not with his brother Edward, through his children. Gloucester took the throne because he could. The haughty Athenians said to the people of Melos, "The strong do what they will, the weak do what they must." That's a paraphrase, but very close. Predators generally feel no need to explain or justify what they do. So, we should keep in mind that fierce human energies were always roiling barely under the graceful surface presented by the royal families and the great lords nearest them. This comes from building a system grounded in bloodlines, or as we would say, genes. The justification would be, perhaps, that such an emphasis lends stability to the primal chaos that might otherwise hold sway in human societies. But we could also say that it brings into play a special chaos all its own. Perhaps the worst problem that arises from the infighting of royal elitists is their tendency, in unleashing the worst in themselves in their struggle against one another, to precipitate a society-wide race to the bottom in terms of the lowest, most raw dimension of human nature. They may drive the entire society they govern to be as cruel, unreasoning, greedy, and chaotic as they themselves are. Who really wants to live in that kind of society? Shakespeare sometimes forces his audiences to behold the worst in humanity, but he doesn't seem pleased to make us dwell there for long. It isn't healthy, and honestly, we already have a pretty good sense of what's there. It seems to have been Shakespeare's view that, like, quote-unquote, the head that wears a crown, Henry IV's famous phrase, social and political stability is always uneasy. It's a matter of temporary balancings and arrangements of strong desires in powerful individuals and groups. There is a baseline conservatism to such a view. Don't tear down or tear apart what you can't easily rebuild. Section: The People's Relation to Their Government, an Enduring Issue in Political Philosophy. In Shakespeare's history plays, we are not dealing with societies wherein there is an equilibrium or even a genuine reciprocity between the people and their government. Average people, if we may borrow that modern construction, had some rights, but they could easily fall victim to a brutal justice system that often resorted to torture, or get conscripted into some violent, tortuous conflict, or be subjected to ruinous taxation, or patently corrupt governmental policies. With little or no practical recourse, England in Shakespeare's time did not have a fully developed, unbiased, equitable government, even if they had the makings of such a government. Did monarchs such as Elizabeth I or James I think of their subjects as adults, much less equals? No. They thought of their subjects as children who needed to be tended to, with the caveat that Elizabethan notions about child-rearing were nowhere near as tender as our ideas on the same subject today. These monarchs expected to be treated with the utmost respect by their quote-unquote children or subjects. We will sometimes see Shakespeare offering a nod to his fellow commoners, but on the whole, he seems to be uninterested in undermining the claims of the royals and the nobility to rule by right, so long as their rule is not more than commonly abusive. That said, Shakespeare doesn't hesitate to point out when his so-called betters do behave abusively. Neither is he shy about positing consequences for such abuse. James I thought that if a king misbehaves, even very badly, only God can judge him, not his subjects, who must remain loyal and long-suffering. While Shakespeare doesn't outright deride such formulations, He is never enthusiastic about them. His bad kings tend to get destroyed, if only because they make themselves vulnerable to some disaster or coup by their disorderly and cruel conduct. But the truth is that people can only take so much abuse, and rebellions will occur from time to time. Shakespeare, of course, knows that. He is never sanguine about the outcomes of rebellions like those made by, say, Wat Tyler in 1381 or Jack Cade in 1450, but he recognizes why such events sometimes occur. In the end, as Shakespeare's King Henry V says, quote unquote, "a king is but a man, and as such, he should respect the common limitations he faces as a suffering, striving human being, among others. Failing to maintain this connection with common humanity may be one of a monarch's worst possible mistakes." End part one of two. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Sunday, September 21st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from Shakespeare, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.